Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today we have a super fantastic guest, Jeff Sauer, the founder and lead instructor of Jeffalytics, and we're going to talk about Google Analytics today. This episode is brought to you by the UI Audit. Want to design web applications that are actually useful to people? This book will help you adopt a smarter approach to UI UX, from product strategy to each individual screen. To get your copy, head over to uibreakfast.com/audit and use your special promo code SUMMERTIME20 to get 20% off any book package. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We are absolutely thrilled to have your insight, and we hope that our listeners will have a feeling that Google Analytics is less scary after listening to the episode today.
Good. That's what we want to do. We want to make it less scary.
So first, before we get started, can you please tell us a bit more about what you do and how you got started? Because you've been with Google Analytics for ages.
Yeah, so my background is in web development, or computer science, if you will. I graduated from university, and really it was before there was a lot of web development jobs out there, and so I took whatever job I could get and had this passion for creating things on the web, and ultimately I ended up creating my own web development firm, which very quickly evolved into more of an SEO firm because I wasn't very good at web development and I was more excited about marketing. And then I went from marketing, SEO, that type of stuff, marketing and SEO. I went over to AdWords management, managing people's Google AdWords accounts, because that was where the money was at the time, at least from my experience. Everybody has different experiences, of course. And then while I was doing Google AdWords, a lot of people would ask me questions like, okay, well, you just generated all these clicks to my website. What did they do? And I didn't have an answer. And so I was looking at analytics packages, like how do I get the answer to what somebody did from an AdWords click? And suddenly, right around that time I was in that path to discovery, Google sends an email and says, try Google Analytics for free in this private beta to only AdWords users. This is around November of 2005. And you could say it was love at first sight. I was one of those beta testers of Google Analytics. And I fell in love. I was able to tell people what was happening on their website based on the clicks that I was generating from AdWords. And from there, I started working with an agency, and we went like crazy for the next, and we grew like crazy basically for the next 8 to 10 years, just working on Google AdWords, Google Analytics, and SEO projects.
Fantastic. So, and Google Analytics are super scary to everyone. And since you've been talking to thousands of students in your practice, what exactly makes it so scary?
Yeah, so I've been very fortunate to teach Google Analytics in a classroom setting in my home city of Minneapolis, Minnesota. I've been fortunate enough to do it about 20 different times. These are 3 to 4 day sessions at a time. Done it 20 times, and not only have I done it 20 times, but I've also had over 1,000 students in person talking about analytics. And when I first started out, I've seen 1,000 eyeballs. I've seen 1,000 people's eyes roll into the back of their head as they look at me talking about JavaScript code, or as I talk about these really complicated things. And so, what I learned very early is that my students would check out immediately if I made it scary. If I made analytics sound scary, complicated, boring, not fun, hard, any of those adjectives to describe analytics. If I did that for them or to them, then they wouldn't finish the class. And so I was like, okay, well, how do we make analytics not any of those things? How do we make it so that it's not scary to somebody? And it turns out that the way that you make it not scary is you don't talk about the analytics at all. You don't talk about statistics. You don't talk about the technology. You don't talk about any of those things up front. Now, yes, I do talk about all those things in my class. It's almost like I give them the ice cream first before I make them take their vitamins. And so the vitamins are JavaScript code, it's data, it's statistics, all those things. But at first, I give them the picture as to what analytics can do for them, the value they can get out of their analytics account. I do all that up front. And then I say, well, if you want to do these things, you need to take your vitamins. You need to do this technical part. And so the way that you make analytics not scary to me is you empower people to know what they can do when all this stuff plays together. You show them an example of what it looks like when this stuff works, when these things are in place. And then also you help them understand that the reason why Google Analytics is such a successful and popular platform, it is on about 70 to 80% of all websites. And it depends on which statistics bureau you're looking at, whether that number is in the 70 range or the 80% range, but it's on a lot of websites. Let's put it that way. And the reason why it's so successful is because it actually makes it easy. It takes the coding part and it really minimalizes how much code you need to do, minimizes how much code you need to put on your website, for example. It takes the part about statistics and giving you a statistical engine, and it just works. So you don't actually need to know statistics. You don't need a PhD. You don't need a PhD in statistics in order to get Google Analytics to work. And that's why it shouldn't be scary to you, because Google's doing all the hard part. They have thousands of engineers just working on Google Analytics, collecting the data. It's the biggest of big data. We're talking trillions and trillions of records of data being collected on Google Analytics. They're doing all that work for you. And what you're doing is you're looking at reports where you can drill down and really understand how people come to your website, what they do on your website, and how do you get them to do more of that action. Basically, you're learning from the past in order to improve your future.
That sounds like an honorable goal. Well, from the web development perspective, even though I'm not a developer, what makes me scared is not actually installing it and making it work. What typical scenario is launching a new project, installing Google Analytics, making sure I'm collecting the data, and then I'm like, all right, I'm done. Now you never go back, and really, unless there is a critical marketing campaign or something. And I'm quite sure that's very similar for, 90% of those 70% websites. What is, what can we do to change that? How can we make those that a deliberate practice?
Yeah, for sure. Because you're absolutely right. When we're working on projects, and our role is to be the developer or to be UX, UI, whatever it is, analytics is a checkbox. It's like, okay, well, if we don't do this, we're going to get yelled at. Or if we don't do this, then nobody's going to know the answer to this. So we need to make sure we incorporate it into our project, but let's not do any more than the minimum. And that's how it works. I've been on many web projects in my life, and I know that's how it works. Essentially, we all have our functions, and unless the analytics person who's responsible for that is at the table and very vocal, then they get the bare minimum in order to be there. Now, and I'm very conscious of that. So one of the things that I teach in my classes is how to set up alerts for yourself so that even though you're not logging into Google Analytics every day, how do you get Google Analytics to tell you when something bad happened? And there's an easy way to do that. You can set up an alert. And this is the first thing that I have everybody do in class is I say, set up an alert if you're not getting any data at all. And people do that, and they will get alerts knowing that things went wrong. Another thing is there's free tools, and then there's free tools, and then there's freemium tools where they get to be a little bit more expensive or they have a cost if you use them a lot that will automatically take your Google Analytics account and turn it into a narrative, and it will give you a monthly and or weekly report as to how you're doing. And so what's cool about that, and this is a tool called Quill Engage. I have Quill Engage installed, and actually since it's the beginning of the month when we're recording this, I have my Quill Engage account told me how I did for the month of April. And so without even having to go into analytics, I can get a comparison side by side of how things performed at the beginning of this month versus last month, for example.
Which leads us to the next question. I know you call the Google Analytics interface beautiful, and from the aesthetic standpoint, I kind of agree with you. But it's also very, very data overloaded and very intimidating interface. And what lacks is that very narrative. Is there any way we can make the native UI more humanly readable?
Yeah, that's probably my biggest problem with Google Analytics right now is that I think that it's beautiful from my perspective, and it's intuitive if you want to do analysis, but it is very much geared towards an analytics person or somebody who wants to do analysis as opposed to somebody who just needs to check it or like wants to check the gauges, right? It's not like it's a dashboard of a car that tells you how you're doing on fuel, how fast you're going. It's not really, you know, they try to do it that way, but I don't think it's really that effective. And I think the reason why, and this is the reason I give, is that when you're signing up and you're looking at a vanilla Google Analytics account, you are looking at the same interface, whether you have a 10-person blog about cat videos as it is for a 100,000 visitor a month, $1 million plus a month in revenue e-commerce store. They get the same Google Analytics. When somebody signs up for Google Analytics, Google doesn't really distinguish between them. They give them the exact same experience, the same access to data, the same paradigm of looking at the web. And as you can imagine, those two website owners, they look at the web completely differently. And so the reason why the dashboard is not very good is because it's trying to be a jack of all trades and it's a master of none. It really basically gives you the most generic, universal information you can get. And that means that it's not customized at all to either of those companies. It's basically the one size fits all marketing. And so the reason, and so it is a data overload, like you say, which I completely agree with, and it's the wrong data because it's not customized. And unfortunately, you don't have a choice as to what you change. You can't change what your homepage is. Everybody gets the same homepage, and there's no level of control over it. And so what the savvy users do is they either find a third party that pulls that data out and then gives you a narrative like you're talking about, or I'm starting to see myself and many others shift to using Google Data Studio as the main reporting tool of Google Analytics, where you can customize your dashboard. And then Google Analytics is really just more of a data collection mechanism.
Whoa, tell us more about Google Data Studio, because I hear the name for the first time, frankly speaking.
Cool. So Google Data Studio, yeah, so my biggest complaint for years about Google Analytics has been their dashboarding system, the native dashboards. They have this potential to create a dashboard that in theory could replace the homepage we're talking about that's very lacking on Google Analytics now. And that's just like, it's like an 8-panel widgeted type dashboard you can create with the different reports from Google Analytics. It was rigid, there's no ability to adjust your data, and it was ugly. So that's the native feature in Google Analytics. And they've sort of marginalized that, and they're basically taking it out of Google Analytics at this point, and it probably won't ever come back or get better. And the reason why they're taking it out is because they have this other tool that's called Google Data Studio, which is an open platform. It is free, which is amazing, and it allows you to take in data sources from all over the internet, all your different data sources that are out there, and you can build a dashboard where you merge data from different sources. So you can have your analytics data, you can have Google Search Console data, you could have your app analytics in there, you can run queries, which that's going to get... queries are probably going to overcomplicate this thing right now, but if you have like a proprietary database, you could query that. You can hook in third-party advertising platforms. You can hook in Google AdWords. Basically, you can create a central nervous system in real time with all of your different reporting, with all your different systems that are out there, and put it into one dashboard that fits your business's needs. And that's all within Google Data Studio.
Well, that's pretty amazing. And that's also pretty scary that all these tools are free. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, free is never free.
Right.
They're saying that there's no such thing as a free lunch. The reason why Google Analytics was free in the first place in 2005 when I first got started, and it's free now unless you use a certain amount of features or data and then you'd have to upgrade to their 360 program. The reason why it's free is because they know that an educated advertiser is going to spend more on advertising. And so Google Analytics was free, so you spent more money on Google AdWords. Now, the last time I checked, Google's revenue for the year 2017 was $110 billion. And that was actually a net positive of $21 billion over the year before. So they generated from $89 billion to $110 billion. They did that just in the year 2017. So they give away these free tools because as long as you stick with the Google ecosystem, that is going to be your primary method of advertising when you get there. The other thing, and we should all take this very seriously, is that Google steers you in the direction of thinking that the world only exists to support search marketing. So if you look at Google Analytics, it is completely biased as to how they classify the data that comes in to your Google Analytics account. It's basically either search marketing or it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, it's like they marginalized Facebook tremendously, yet they make it look like Google is the center of the universe. Now, the thing is, for many websites, Google is the center of the universe, but it does have an inherent bias in there. And that's what the cost of free is that free is always going to bias you towards the Google solution. And they're always going to continue to do that as long as their profits and their revenue is at a record level.
Tell us a bit more about other tools that are somewhat relevant to Google Analytics, for example, Google Search Console, because you have to set it up separately. And for me, it was quite a mystery, like, what exactly it does and why doesn't Google Analytics collect that information first place, and you have to use a separate tool for that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So this is when I have to geek out, okay? So I gave you the ice cream for the first 15 minutes of this interview. And in order to answer that question, I do need to get a little bit geeky. And so the difference between Google Analytics data and Google Search Console data comes down to how the data is collected. So data collected in Google Analytics, you are collecting as a first-party person using JavaScript in a web browser. So you are collecting that primarily. You're the one who's collecting it. It is through your website. You own that data, essentially. You're collecting data, and then Google Analytics processes it for you. Of course, they give you the data collection mechanism too, but think about it this way. If you put some code on your website for Google Analytics, that data is being sent to yours and you own it. Now, Google Search Console, you actually don't own the data at all. It's Google Search Console. Google will basically take all the information they know about a certain domain name or a website, and they'll just collect that regardless of whether you claim it or not. And so that data is not being fed by your first party data collection at all. It's actually Google's internal database as to how many times that website domain name or that domain name essentially shows up in a search result. It's how many times that domain name showing up in the search result is the impression. It's how many times that domain name is clicked through on in a search result. It's how many times that domain name is crawled by their crawler. So it's basically Google's internal database. And so the reason why Google Search Console doesn't have as rich of data as Google Analytics is because you technically own your Google Analytics data, even though it's in their platform. But if you look at the data processing agreement, you own the data. They're basically just a catalyst giving you the ability to collect and report, but you're the owner of it. Versus Search Console data, that's their internal database, and it doesn't make a lot of business sense for them to give you complete access to the data they collected on your behalf.
Oh, that's a wonderful, interesting, dramatic difference. It never occurred to me as a user that the difference is so large, actually.
Yeah, I actually, this is my first time explaining the difference in this way. So I think that, yeah, that's exactly how it works. But it's funny, like, I don't think about it that way either. I'm like, man, why does Search Console not give me nearly as much data as Google Analytics? And that's what it is that you're taking Google's database and they're giving you, out of their own generosity, information that they have about you.
So let's go back to making use of that standard classic interface. Are there any, recipes would be a good word, shortcuts that regular humans can take to make any sense of their data? Let's talk about probably smaller businesses, not 100,000 visitors per month shops.
Yeah, sure. So this is like one of those ones where it almost sounds patronizing to say it, but so many people don't do it. Like you said earlier, that if 70% of the people use Google Analytics and 90% of the people that use Google Analytics don't do anything with it, this is the first thing you should do then if you're in that 90%, is that you should set up a goal, at least one goal, to tell Google Analytics what you define as success. So you need to tell Google Analytics what makes you successful and set up the goals. And so if you don't have goals set up, then basically all you're going to know is about the window shoppers, you know, using like a retail term, people who walked by and just looked in the windows. You're not going to know anything about the people who ended up buying. And so if you want Google Analytics to be more about the actions people take as opposed to just the overall number of impressions that you get or the overall number of people who are aware of you, then you need to set up goals. And once you set up goals, all these other reports become much more useful. So, for example, when you have goals in place, you can get your conversion rate. you can get your page value, which is the value of each page on your website relative to your goals and your e-commerce. You can set up things like multi-channel funnels. You can do assisted conversions. You can do attribution modeling. All these are more advanced ways of looking at the people who come into your website, and it's all tied to the outcomes that are happening. So the biggest shift you can make, the biggest hack, if you will, is to focus your analytics on outcomes and not on just surface level metrics like impressions and bounce rate and stuff like that. The more targeted you are with what you're looking at towards the outcomes you want, the things that either make you money or have a positive economic impact on your overall website, those are things you want to train Google Analytics to do for you.
So there, that's a great piece of advice, definitely. So by goals, we do mean specific pages. For example, thank you page is a classic example of a goal. Am I doing it right?
Yep. So definitely. Thank you pages is, or some kind of page that indicates, like, that gives somebody a message saying thank you for your order, thank you for your lead, whatever it is. That's probably, and what I say in my class is that 80 to 90% of the time, a thank you page is the goal that you're going to choose, or some kind of page that's out there. The other 10 to 20% of the time, it's going to be a event, which an event is something that happens within a page on a website. So it's not a thank you page. It's like when they click on a button that says, you know, when they click on a pop-up modal, when they submit their email address or something like that. That's an event versus a page view.
Mm-hmm. But you can always, typically with email marketing providers, you can set up a custom thank you page, which can be hosted on your site. And then we get that classic understanding of a thank you page goal,
that's
right?
That's the cleanest way to do it for sure. Mm-hmm. And also that's nice because then you can put a remarketing pixel on there. And you can use it as either suppression of your remarketing or a contribution to your remarketing. And so if somebody's seen that thank you page, now they can get put onto a remarketing list or taken off of a remarketing list.
Mm-hmm. So that you don't keep promoting the same goodie to them that I already bought.
Exactly. Yep.
Let me roll back a little bit to the more primitive things that somewhat in our universe classify the success of the site, define the success of the site, which is, you know, monthly unique visitors, monthly impressions of the website, and those surface metrics, as you call them. So if you want to say that your site is successful, what do you measure? Unique visitors, page views, anything else?
Yeah, so it's easy for me to say that the most important thing to measure is conversions, mm-hmm. which I think it is. But in an absence of conversions, or in addition to conversions, I think it is totally natural to look at the number of sessions that go to your site or the number of users. So and this is something where Google changed the terminology. It used to be absolutely unique visitors, and then number of visits. Now it's called users and sessions. But basically, you know, if your number of users is going up, the number of unique cookies in the cookie pool that they see, if that goes up from, you know, 1,000 to 2,000, then that's good. Like that's nobody ever complains about having going from 1,000 to 2,000 because it's very prominent. And I even look at that as a measure of success for sure if I get there. But The problem can sometimes be that that's not necessarily an indicator of quality, right? So quantity is not always an indicator of quality. You could get 1,000 more sessions or 1,000 more users going to your website, and then you get zero goals that are accomplished. Well, then if you keep on trying to push that traffic to your site that doesn't convert, then you're just the same as you would have been if you had had 1,000. So you might think that it's really successful, but it's not getting the action taken that you want to. And so you can't, like, traffic is good. Like, there's no doubt that usually 2,000 people come into your site and knowing about your brand is better than 1,000. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to help you get closer to your goals. And in the business world, or in almost any world, even nonprofits, like, the goal is to get more of the favorable actions that you want, the things that fuel your economic engine. That's like the universal thing in having a website for the most part, unless it's purely informational. But even then, just a purely informational website, they at least want to make their money back for they pay for hosting, or they want to get more donations to help them pay for it. There's always a reason to want to have more of the outcomes you're looking for.
That's a great point. Let's imagine, I don't know if you can give us numbers like that, but let's imagine there is a SaaS landing page website of a SaaS product, mm-hmm. and there is a classic, you know, free trial sign up. So what would be the classic conversion rate for such page? I would love you to compare things like free courses and other lead magnets that probably get way more conversions than free trials or some other things that you can do for people to opt in.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to give an exact number, but I'll try. But it's based on, I mean, it's so much is based on the traffic quality. So when we talk about a free trial, you know, how many, like a SaaS company has so many different ways to give somebody a free trial. Mm-hmm. There's their content marketing on their blog. That might offer a free trial. That's probably, if it's coming in on a blog post and it's like a little bit of a, you know, like a pop-up window, then that might be, you know, that might be a lower percentage because it's their first time learning about you. Versus if you do a remarketing ad to people who saw your content marketing, then and they click through, then your conversion rate to a free trial might be much higher because they're somewhat aware of you, and the act of clicking means that they're coming back for that action to go do the free trial. So you might get a 5% conversion rate on the remarketing and only a 2% on the blog post. And then if you do Facebook, you know, there's obviously multiple types of remarketing. If you do Facebook promoted posts to your existing audience and they're there, that's going to be a much higher rate of success usually than people who are not on your Facebook fan page. If you're doing organic search to somebody who's not aware of your brand name at all, it's going to be a lower conversion rate than if somebody types in your brand name. Brand is usually an intent, right? So that means they know who you are, so they're much more likely to be receptive. And I've seen this my whole career. If somebody's looking for your brand name, it converts significantly higher than somebody who's not looking for your brand name, which sounds obvious, but a lot of people don't capture that demand or they don't properly handle that piece. They're not even visible when somebody types in their brand name. And so those are some examples of the conversion rate will be anywhere from 0.001% on a blog with no clear call to action, all the way up to 5-10% if you're taking your warm list and you're warming them up even further and getting them to take the action you want. And so it can be across the board, but it's more, I mean, there's all kinds of tricks around like what the page is and how many elements you have in your form, what your, you know, what the headline says and A/B split testing and all that stuff. Those all can have an impact, but I think quality of traffic and context of traffic is just as important, if not more important, for a young startup company that doesn't have a lot of visits. It's about the context of why did they come to this thing in the first place, and do they have enough information to make that decision? So it's a lot more based on that person's, like, where they're at in the buying cycle than it is about trying to trick them with one headline versus the other.
So it's not essentially about one average conversion rate. It's very situational as opposed to, you know, just one landing page where everybody comes to.
Yeah, I mean, my if you look at averages, no, don't look at averages. I say all the time, averages are lies because basically, like, I think the average male in the United States, the height is like 5'9" tall and the weight is like 180 pounds or something like that. But like most people are either much, much smaller than that or within 10%, you know, 10% bigger than that or 10% smaller than that. And so it's like, who's average? And then if you look at somebody in a room, there's nobody who's actually average in that case.
I think there was a story about U.S. Military. Average size, and nobody fit that uniform.
Yep, exactly. And it was like the cockpit size was for the average person, and all these pilots were crashing because they were either too small or too big for it. Yep.
So another question about averages. Well, please tell me if that's not an appropriate question. So there is a startup and they are saying we're gaining traction, which means we're getting some traffic. And at what stage, what number of monthly uniques can we talk about getting traction as opposed to being completely silent? I don't know, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 uniques per month.
The way that I look at it is that until you're at the point where your traffic is more of a funnel where it's continuously coming in and spitting out leads or spitting out sales, until it's the point where it's predictable, then everything, almost everything that comes in should be the effect of your marketing efforts. And so if you're putting a lot of time into blogging, then you're probably going to have a over-correction or an over-representation of blog conversions as opposed to something else. If you spend a lot of time emailing your list, then you're going to have email as your main way of people coming in. And so usually until you get to the point where you have a really balanced amount of traffic, it's going to be very much heavily influenced towards one thing or the other. So for example, a SaaS company, they'll find that whenever they send out an email with an offer, their conversion rate goes much higher than when they don't have an offer. Now, it sounds obvious, but that's ultimately how it ends up being, is that people don't know that you're open for business unless you give them some kind of offer. And so I think at the beginning, having the offer and doing that consistently is much more important than focusing on having 1,000 or 2,000 visits. Mm-hmm. And then once you know that your offer works, then you work on scaling it up. And now, almost always the way to scale it up, almost like 99% of the time from my experience in an online business, is through paid media. You know, you can't scale, you can scale through organic media or word of mouth or viral type stuff, but it doesn't scale in the same way that paid media does, because paid media can just keep on just flowing. It's like a river of opportunity coming in from people who are searching or people who are on the different platforms where you can pay for that opportunity. And so you can use your budget in order to control that. And so I always recommend testing things out using your network and using organic techniques and then scaling with paid.
One of my questions is somewhat not directly relevant to Google Analytics, but more about strategy. What if your product is not something that people actively search for, which means the level of awareness is somewhat low? For example, my previous product, Tiny Reminder, was one of those productivity tools that people cannot imagine that they exist. We had Brendan Dunn's Right Message, which is website personalization, and people hardly ever search for a website personalization, as another example. So what do you do with products like that are not searchable?
Yeah, so if it's an industry that is going to be there in the future, then you have to sort of become the market creator. And, you know, so for example, marketing automation was a big thing in the mid-2000s. If you were just getting started back in the day, nobody knew what marketing automation was. And in fact, the agency that I still own part of, they were started as a marketing automation company or marketing automation agency, and that was their specialty from like the from 2003 until 2008. And they got no traction at all because nobody had heard of marketing automation. And fortunately for that industry of marketing automation, what ended up happening was venture capitalists backed these big companies, and then they flooded the market so much with talking about marketing automation that suddenly people were searching for it. And that search was actually coveted. And there's somebody's going to write a book about this, I swear. But it's like the wars around the word marketing automation. I've had two conversations in the last 2 months, believe it or not, about the marketing automation wars from the mid, you know, late 2000s, the early 2010s. And it was a pretty crazy story how cutthroat it was in that area. And so in the annals of that story, basically, if you're ahead of the market and you're not the one who's being the market creator, then yes, there's going to be zero organic demand or zero demand for your term if you're creating a new market. And so, but also there's nobody else, there's not as much competition, right? So it's like a trade-off. Basically, there's nobody searching for you, but there's also less competition, so you can be the one who floods the market. And then if you succeed, then you suddenly are the pinnacle of this big category. But I would agree with you that if there's no search volume, then that's probably not the trick. That's probably not the tactic you're going to utilize to grow the industry. It's going to be more around content marketing. It's going to be more around outreach. Could be influencer marketing. There's so many other tactics that I would do and search would be the last thing. I would maybe have a evergreen search campaign turned on to capture the little demand that we have, and then everything else I would just focus on more being the market creator.
That sounds like great advice. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. I think we need to wrap up because we're running out of time, even though we could probably keep talking about that for ages. I would love to have your input on reading you can do on the topic, and also on the tools that people can use adjacent tools that will help out in fighting that complexity of Google Analytics.
Yeah, so as far as reading goes and videos, I definitely have tried to become the premier. I'm trying to create the market around education, around analytics. And so I have a very active YouTube channel mm-hmm. talking about these things, and I have a very active blog about these things. And then I also, I mean, there's a lot of really great blogs that are out there that you can read. I think from, as far as like reading books and stuff like that, generally speaking, even the authors admit that the way that a book takes to go to print, it's usually out of date or the interface has changed before mm-hmm. they, like by the time they publish it. So it's mostly audio, video, or reading and video stuff. And so ones that I really like, and aside from my own stuff, which I love, Measure School is really good. Simo Ahava's blog is really good. There's a guy named Analytics Mania that I really like. There's Optimize Smart is one that I really like. Those are some really cool blogs that are out there about Google Tag Manager and Google Analytics. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Google Tag Manager, but that's pretty exciting thing as well. And so those are the ones that I would say are really good to look at. And then the more time you can spend on, just really, depending on where you're at, if you want to take a course, there's a lot of great online courses about these topics, and they'll take you from, beginner to more advanced topics if you want to make it less mystifying. I personally do have an analytics course where mm-hmm. I teach people, I make no assumptions at the beginning. I give you the ice cream at the beginning. Here's all the cool stuff you can do with analytics. And then I make you take your vitamins, and I make you get really into the how it actually works so you can become certified in analytics if you want to. And so that's the other thing to look at is, depending on where you're at, the difference between learning from blogs and learning from an online course, frankly, is the amount of narrative that's put around it. And so when I do an online course or when I do a blog post, it's like a discrete, beginning, middle, end in that post. And you can really compile a lot of knowledge by reading a bunch of different blog posts. But my course has a beginning, middle, end over the course of 12 hours, basically saying, here's the absolute beginner. And then we go so far in depth that it takes me 12 hours to get you to the point where you're ready to go out there and to do these things. And so both of these things are valid and they both work. It depends on what type of commitment you'd want to make to analytics among your other responsibilities.
So you have one famous course that is paid, and that is amazing. And you have some awesome numbers. It's like 5,000 people have already taken it or something like that.
Yeah.
Tell us more about where people can find it.
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, I did the course in person 20 times. And then once on my 20th time, I thought I was good enough to do it online. And so it's available at analyticscourse.net. And if you go there on the homepage, there's like a free sample of the lessons. And so you can sign up for that free mini course. And there's like, I think we'll mail you 4 different lessons. And you can get a feel for my teaching style. Obviously, if you're listening to this, you get a pretty good idea as to how this is how I talk. This is how I educate people. But you can check out that free course. And then if you stick around that free course at the end of it, you might get a little bit of an incentive or discount to take the full course.
Great. I'm sure our listeners will benefit at least from the free course for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something where if you can get over the scary part of analytics, it is really powerful and empowering, and it could help you back up a lot of your opinions. It can give you a research and fact-based input to your organization, and so you can become a lot more valuable to your organization because you're not just doing this off of instinct. You're doing it from a position of facts and numbers and strength in numbers.
Absolutely. And what about you personally? Your homeland is jefflytics.com.
Yep, that's my website, jefflytics.com. And homeland is another story, but we'll get into that one a little bit later, probably. Maybe never. Who knows?
Can people find you on Twitter?
Yes. So, yep, I have Twitter at jefflytics, at Jeff Sauer. And, yeah, that's it. I think I have a Facebook page for Jefflytics. But really, the Jefflytics blog is where most of my stuff comes through now. And then the YouTube channel, I've been investing. I did 90 videos in 90 days to start this year, 2018.
Oh, my goodness.
And yeah, and it seriously is the most work I've ever put into any project. but we did it 90 days in a row. We released a YouTube video and a blog post accompanying it. And each one was about, you know, it was about a 5 to 10 minute video. And so my team was working really hard to deliver quality stuff. And now we're down to about twice a week we publish these videos.
That's still a ton of content.
Yep, we're doubling down or tripling down on content, and I've never felt better as a result.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for sharing your wisdom today. Well, I wish we had like 5 hours to talk about it and actually share some practical stuff, but it's great that you shared at least some top-level strategy on how to approach it.
Sure. And that's like you said, if you want 5 more hours of me or 12 more hours, then check out my courses. Then you can get, if you like this, it only gets more in depth and more practical from there.
Great. Well, thank you for your time again and have a great day.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.